गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। We offer our repeated prostrations or honor and praise to the principle of Sri Guru in all its forms, guides, guardian angels, invisible protectors, and visible ones, Guru Gauranga, the golden divine Lord, Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, divine couple, and of course all that it's included in between all of that, which is everything, including us, all the bhaktas, actualized bhaktas, in potential bhaktas, which again includes everything and everyone, we offer our namaha, our putting aside our false sense of self, and with our the realest sense of self we could possibly present, we offer that in loving dedication. So with that, we begin today officially our satsang, November 8th, 2025. Greetings from Sri Mayapur, where I've been, I don't know, for a week or so. I can't calculate exactly, almost a week. We are preparing for a pilgrimage. We will start in a few days, less than a week here. At the same time, I'm visiting some friends and sadhus and sadhvis, and trying to, honor being in the Dham. As you will know, in our tradition, Dhambas, or residence in a holy abode, the Dham. There, of course, every place is holy, every place is sacred. God is in every, the Sweet Absolute is in every atom. But also, we would say there are some special forms of sacredness into the overall generic sacredness, omnipresent one. So the Dhams are examples of that. Not only tirthas are places of crossing, like a tirtha are places that people sometimes go to leave their body from there to attain liberation. But for us, a dham is not just a place of to go to cross and go somewhere else, but actually the place to go and to stay forever, so to say. Well, so a dham on earth is somehow a reminder of that place, that, and a place is not geography merely, but it's a place made of emotion, as we'll say over and over again. So we want to reside in a land of faith, as Srila Siddhar Maharaj will put it, in a land of bhava, in a place constituted of a certain particular emotional disposition. So being here in our tradition, just being in the Dham is considered bhakti, Swarup Siddha Bhakti. No, intrinsic bhakti, just being here. It sounds a little bit lazy. Just being in the Dham, by just being here, I'm doing bhakti, right? It's not as an excuse not to do anything else. Not that we come to the Dham to go to the bed, eat chips, and watch Netflix in the Dham. Now, the last thing you want to do in the Dham is do all that together. But just being in the Dham is bhakti, and the implication is, what if while being doing bhakti by being in the Dham, you engage in any other expression of devotion on top of that? So that's what we are trying to do, and again, hoping to internalize the experience and carry that fragrance with us whenever, wherever we may go around this globe. So thank you so much for your presence today, always, but also today. And for coming to satsang, our weekly act of presence, trying to show up for the truth, trying to show up in trying to enter a room full of mirrors in the good sense of the term, right? If you sit in a circle with other sadhus and sadhvis, sincere practitioners, it's somehow a room of mirrors. You know, you get mirrored in everyone else. In the healthiest possible way, also challenging probably, but also mirrored in a healthy way, not toxic comparison, not superiority, inferiority complex, but a mutual mirroring of potential, a mutual remembering all that we can be. by bearing witness to the other person sharing and thoughts and insights and experience. So it's a sacred time, sacred moment, and very blessed to be honoring that with all of you together. So as usual, we invite you to present any offering you may like to bring to the circle today in the form of a quest. Sometimes we call it question, we may like to call it quest. The question set us on a quest, on a journey, or any topic, any theme you may feel inspired to explore further together. Anything, anything, everything is welcome. And I'm seeing two raised hands, digital hands. And of course, if you have anything else, you can raise yours. And the first one comes from Abhinandana from India. So we invite her to unmute her phone, her microphone, and more than welcome.
Pranam Maharaj, from your epistemic hierarchy section of the first book, I got to know that to know truth, one needs to read Shastra. Am I audible, Maharaj?
Yeah, I mean, not fully, but at least maybe it's my problem with my amplification. But yeah, I can hear so far.
So now, like, okay. So the first, I got to know that to know the truth, one needs to read Shastra, which is the Bhagavatam and the Goswami Granthas. So before that, I saw like two ways of doing it, like for me personally. One, to know truth, like one is to study the books and the other was to be led by my questions. I find it hard to do it the first way because I have a lot of questions and it's easier for me to grasp when I go by them, like to be more clear. And if I have to give an example, like I have questions about how do you offer your career to Krishna and questions about interfaith and all of these. Were, I learned about all of these things through works of devotees. And I had questions about fall of Jiva, personalism, love, which is all of your books. And Radha Madhav Prabhu's website has so much answers. And all these people talk from Shastra and it helps to understand my questions. But then when I go by them, I don't have time to like read. I don't know how to see this. Like, can you help me understand what way should you like?
Yes, okay. Thank you for the question or the scenario that you are presenting us with, which is not only your personal experience, I will say. So of course there are many things to say. First, we are saying, okay, in order to know the truth, we have to resort to Shastra. Yes, but also we need to qualify that statement, not to make it a, how to say, too rigid, political, institutional, hierarchical, localized idea from one group, from one scripture. This is the truth is here and only what it means to know the truth through Shastra. What Shastra, again, Shastra is what Rupa Jiva Goswami will call Vaidusha Pratyaksha, which basically means Shastra or scripture or sacred scripture revealed sound is Vaidusha Pratyaksha. The first-hand experience, Pratyaksha, of the Vaidusha, which means of the seer of truth, of someone who is contacting reality unfiltered. Right, free from masks, free from assumptions, free from prejudice, free from upadis, we will say, limited designations. So how does reality look like when we present ourselves to reality undressed from all these masks? Reality shows itself for what it is. So Shastra, the revelation in any tradition, ideally, is the accounts of these seers, right? So it's a form of pratyaksha. That's an important point. Pratyaksha means personal experience. Again, one thing is the personal experience of an enlightened being, a seer of truth. Another thing is the personal experience of a conditioned soul, which is his or her perception of things is filtered with so much stuff. I mean, there are so many degrees of filters and things that can get in the way, that can be in between us and actual reality. And of course, Shastra is defined as the accounts of self is self-evident in the sense that it's coming from seers of reality. Of course, we have to have our own experience of that. You cannot just accept what I'm saying blindly, because I can tell you, okay, this book I have here, whatever that is Shastra, is the revealed truth coming from the perception of seers. So I accept it completely. But if you have no clue what the book talks about and you have no experience about what the book talks about, hopefully you don't accept what I'm saying blindly, right? Because if not, you become a very easily potentially cult member. So my point is, in principle, that's it, but then we have to have our own experience connected to the experience of the people that are speaking in Shastra. Again, Shastra is the account, the experience of seers, but we have to have our own pratyaksha, our own experience in relation to their experience. So if we are honest and sincere, we will say that's our part of our adhikar or our eligibility qualification to look for the truth, because we are talking here about looking for the truth. First of all, you have to sincerely be looking for the truth. This is not like a casual exercise. Oh yeah, I'm looking for the truth. If I just happen to pop up on it, I'll welcome it to my door. If not, no, that's not looking for the truth. No, that's why once someone asked Srila Prabhupada, does anyone and everyone need a guru? I say no. Only those who are looking for the truth. Because ideally, a guru is someone who will assist you in that pursuit, right? And train your vision for that. Again, ideally, a guru is a seer of truth who will help the disciple to develop that eye as well. So again, Shastra is that. Okay, Srimad-Bhagavatam, Goswami Granta, and I will not limit Shastra to only those two, which of course there are not only two. Goswami Granta is a magnificent corpus of scripture, and Srimad-Bhagavatam in itself it's not limited to one book. In one sense, the Goswami Granta is an elaboration of the Bhagavatam, right? The very word Srimad-Bhagavatam means that which is related to Bhagavan. So that which is related to Bhagavan is Bhagavatam. Therefore, we have Chaitanya Bhagavatam also, and so on and so forth. Brihad-Bhagavatamrita, Laghu-Bhagavatamrita. There are so many Bhagavatams over there. So I'm saying all this so we don't limit the notion of scripture to this book. And that's it, that's Shastra. No, there's so much more. Chaitanya Charitamrita, Goswami Granta, Bhagavad Gita, Vedanta Sutra, Upanishad, books from sister traditions, that if they come from a genuine seer of truth, that's Shastra in its own way. So, yes. In order to know the truth, we have to contact Shastra. But again, we have to approach the revealed message with a genuine, sincere inquiry and willingness. Because if not, you may be reading the most esoteric, enlightened text. You may be in front of the highest saint. But if your heart is not in the right place, you may not receive much. So there's a part that we need to do. That's my point. It's not about automatically opening Shastra, you access the truth. No, many people have opened the Bhagavatam and say this is a crazy account of an immoral god or whatever, no, by reading Rasa Lila and throw it into the trash bin. Many books of the devotees have been found in trash bin, by the way, and many people have been made devotees by finding those books in the trash bin. That's interesting, no? Because the previous person didn't become devotee, threw the book into the trash bin, but somehow the next person became a devotee. So that speaks about from which place each one approached that same book. For one person, the book is worthy of being thrown into a trash bin. For the other person, a book is worthy of being picked from the trash bin open, and so much more, right? So that on one side, I think that's important to have in place. The qualifications of the student of the truth. That's why in every verse of the scripture, every main verse of Shastra, that the qualification of the guru is described first, the qualification of the student is described. Always. Bhagavad Gita 4:34, Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. All that is about the disciple. Then Upadekshant te gyanam gyaninas tattva darshinaha. Then comes the guru last line. Bhagavatam the same. Tasmat gurum prapadyata jignyasa shreya uttama. All about the disciple. Sabde parichanishnatam brahma brahmani upasamashrayam. Then the guru. Like implying, make sure that you are acquiring the proper qualities that you need to cultivate as a student, as a seeker. Because if not, even though all the quality of the guru or the shastra is there, you may miss the whole thing, because you may be looking for the wrong thing, for the wrong thing in the right place, for the right thing in the wrong place, whatever. No? So we need to do our own part. And of course, it requires some faith, some openness. Okay, I don't know if this book is revelation or not, but I'm looking for something. I'm opening for the experience. It's a sort of experiment. So we open to the experience of, well, okay, let's open the Bhagavad Gita. That's what I did when I was 19 years old. That was an experiment. Let's see what happens when I open this book. And that was an interesting experiment. As you can see, here we are still. But I had to open it. Myself, open the book and open myself to the book. Again, not only you open the book, but the book opens you. No, in the case of these books, which are not books, they are revelation, revealed sound. They are something alive. I say something that didn't need to be put online, probably. I'm being censored from now on. That's a new layer of editing. So yeah, there are certain books that are very advanced, very esoteric. And there are other which may be more introductory. And of course, there is a place to make some idea of that. Okay. Again, classical sequence, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Charitamrita. Of course, it's not about reading the books, but understanding their essence. No? Because sometimes I've seen because many of these books are not precisely short, right? Bhagavad Gita may be shorter by comparison. Still, it's not if you read with commentaries, but then you get Srimad Bhagavatam, right? Which is like 15 times, more than 10 times longer. Chaitanya Charitamrita, longer, very long. So for some, it's kind of a lifelong project to even dare to take the covering, this plastic covering of the books, and take that out, and then dare to open page one. Let's be honest, guys, we may not be all of you. The most voracious readers in the plan. I'm nerdy by nature, so I have no problem devouring books and reading them many times. And I'm not saying that I'm better than you for doing that. It's just I was nerdy as a child and I loved to read always. But as the time progresses, people read less and less, unfortunately. So then I give you a book of 18,000 verses. It doesn't sound too user-friendly. It may sound a little intriguing. Or we think, okay, then I have to read it and I have to finish it. So we read the Bhagavatam more in like thinking about when to finish. Like when you chant rounds and you're thinking when to finish the rounds. That's not the ideal way of chanting rounds. And that's not the ideal way of reading the Bhagavatam. No, it's not like finishing and then telling all your community, I read the Bhagavatam now, I finish it. The very moment you say I finished it, you show that you didn't understand anything. Because how can you finish reading the Bhagavatam? No. If you say I finished it, you are finished. Because the nature of the Bhagavatam, the nature of the Gita is that they can never be finished. They're eternal, they're ever evolving, their intrinsic meaning is always expanding. So you cannot finish it. You shouldn't read it thinking that you can finish it or you should finish it. And by mere reading of a book, that doesn't warrant you understood it. So that's why in those same books, over and over again, you find the emphasis of guru, sadhu, sadhu sangha, in order to approach shastra. Yes, shastra is so important. But in shastra, you find interaction between teacher and student over and over again, and discussions and sharing among peers. And lots of questions, as you mentioned, Abhinandana. It's not that this is a separate affair. You may say, okay, my way of understanding the truth is by asking, having multiple questions and asking them with someone that I trust, etc. And you go to Shastra, and that's basically the main pattern of Shastra. People being filled with questions. presenting them to a relevant other, no? Parikshit Maharaj to Sukadeva Goswami, Arjuna to Krishna, Yudhishthira Maharaj to Narad Muni, Vyasadeva to Narad Muni, Narad Muni to Brahma, whomever is in the session. But you, Mahaprabhu to Ramananda Roy, you name it. But if you see it from that perspective, the whole main corpus is always back and forth, Ishtagoshti, no? Questions and answers, Q&A. So that's a very intrinsic pattern and way of learning the truth. So that's why that's recommended. One, if one approaches a scripture, and scripture again, it doesn't end with the classical works. Now, Shastra also extends to contemporary books that can be written by practitioners of all times. So it's not again, okay, Shastra is only books written from 1 millennia ago and before that. After that, revelation is not that sacred any longer. So no. Of course, after that, whatever is written in a particular tradition ideally is based on the original revelation, but also should add further, not only further insight, but further language and articulation that makes the sharing relevant and relatable to where we are in our journey today. So in that sense, in some cases, and I hope you understand my point and you are not scandalized by it, but in many cases, books written by contemporary sadhus may be more important for us. Because in those books, again, as long as they are based in the ancient revelation, they are conveying the essence of the Bhagavad and of the Gita, of the whatever Shastra, conveying its essence, many times devoid of some cultural baggage and details that sometimes may get in the way, in a language that may be relevant with added insight, because again, this original revelation is not stuck in time, it's a living thing. So that living thing should be expressed through contemporary members of a parampara, of a lineage. That's why we speak about the living school. No? Parampara is a living school. It's not just parroting or copy-pasting what has been said centuries ago without adding anything new in terms of depth and breadth and whatever. So that's how the transmission remains alive and we can feel alive. We can feel the live wire, the connection with the current. The current should be, remain current, right? To make a play of words. So again, and it's always important to have someone that accompanies us. You can use the word guide, mentor, guru. That's a word only, but it's useful. So in that case, according to our situation, to our mood, there can be some adjustments. You know, for some people, it may be required, okay, give me the sequence, start with this book, this. But the same sequence of book may not be applicable for other person according to their situation, their adhikar. Some people may have more questions than others. And for some people, the learning and the growth and the insight comes a lot by this back and forth in Ishtagoshti. So it's very personalized at the end of the day. There is no like final formula. So again, I personally will think, yeah, it's good to become familiar with the ancient revelation, so to say, the original revelation of any tradition you are belonging to, but also at the same time not get quote unquote stuck there in the sense of I won't read anything from anyone else because that's never as good as the original one. Now, if the original one is really truly good, it will create a further expansion of that goodness in the form of subsequent works and revelations coming in a living school of students and teachers. So I'm not giving you any definitive answers, you can see, Abhinandana, but I don't know if anything of what I'm sharing makes some sense to you, it's helpful.
Thank you so much. I think I really need to go back and think about this, about what you have told. And it has definitely like striked a lot of points. I mean, something. Thank you. And I will surely.
Thank you. Okay. So before going to the next raised hand, I see raised hand from Jayadev and from Kanupriya. So we'll go there in a minute, but as most of you know, and if not, I'm introducing you to the next to part of what our satsanga is about, which is our in-between breakout rooms that we like to call them breakthrough rooms as well, where we invite groups of three approx to get in more intimate space to share with each other any further reflections, any further churning, boiling of the milk, as Srila Prabhupada will say, churning of the ocean of nectar. You pick the analogy you want to make the what we are sharing even deeper and broader, that can only happen also in community, so we can get to continue connecting with each other on a deeper level. So you will be invited to this room for a few minutes, and we'll see each other in a few more minutes, continuing with our sharing. Welcome you back. Yes, it's always too short, we know it, but it will always be too short, and that's part of the deal, right? Always some thirst for more, ever evolving, infinite reality we are addressing, so there's always space for more, and that's our hope, that's our thirst, that's our cause of celebration. So I hope you had a nourishing time, further turning this discussion on the topic that we just shared about revelation and Shastra and guidance and how to approach this important truths. So we'll continue with the next raised hand, who was came from Germany with Jayadev Prabhu. So we invite him to unmute himself.
Thank you, Swami Padmanabha. Thank you for providing and supporting the space. Such an awesome opportunity for me here. And these days, I'm still processing this very inspiring conversation between Namaraj Prabhu and Hari Prasad Prabhu, the recent podcast about Raganuga Bhakti. And as far as I understood from the Nectar of Devotion, Raganuga Bhakti means to follow the Ragatmika devotee in a certain sense. And so I heard actually once from a senior devotee, from a senior Vaishnava, that r this Raganuga Bhakti also includes following the footsteps of a spiritual master. And I can see that, for example, if we follow Rupa Goswami, who is a Ragatmika devotee, there I could apply this idea. And maybe even if we follow the followers of Rupa Goswami. So this is my first question. How much does Raganuga Bhakti mean following the footsteps of the spiritual master? And the other question is, how far do we get with our imagination in Raganuga Bhakti? With imagination, I mean, if we in our meditation try to connect with Vrindavan, for example, with Krishna's associates, try to participate, try to serve, whatever. How far do we go with our imagination?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, a lot to say about Raganuga Bhakti, about everything, of course. Yeah, that was a nourishing conversation between Hari Prasad Prabhu and Rasa. And of course, there's so much to say about it, and I appreciate that there was a space to speak about it, because I know that in many, not in all, but in some Gaudiya circles, there's not much conversation about Raganuga Bhakti at all. Or if there is, there is no much clear concepts about what that is, and sometimes about to think We do not practice Raganuga Bhakti, or Raganuga Bhakti is a later stage. First comes Vaidhi Bhakti. So Sadhana Bhakti is divided in Vaidhi first and Raganuga then. And those are not the ways that Rupa Goswami have explained that. As again, Hariparsha Prabhu tried to make the emphasis of, okay, let's go to Rupa Goswami, no? Because we cannot just start from zero with our own ideas about what Raganuga Bhakti is, right? There is some, as we, in relation to what we talked before, there is some established traditions and tradition and revelation. So being part of a tradition doesn't mean just you made up whatever you want and that's the tradition now. But there can be new insights for sure, there should, but there is a foundation of revelation that is there and that has to be acknowledged, honored, but first you have to know what the revelation is. Now, how can you honor something that you have no clue what is what's talking about? So it's important that as much as we have time and capacity that we get familiar to what's our tradition about. And again, with this, I don't want to enter into a conversation that makes some of you feel guilty because of not being that familiar with certain aspects of the tradition. But I think there is a place to make clear that if you want to go deep into something, you first need to get an idea of what's that something, right? Okay, I want to be an architect. I want to build buildings. So probably you will be listening and writing and reading about building buildings without building any building for years. If you try to do so to build a building before that, you go to jail. So here we are talking about building another building, building a temple of divine love in your heart. That's a pretty sophisticated building. So you may require some time for understanding the sacred architecture of that sacred building in your heart. And that implies, yeah, study, guidance, clear concept, proper sambandha, proper orientation. And in the context of Raganuga Bhakti, this is no exception to that. So that said, you made two questions. One is, how much does Raganuga Bhakti means following the footsteps of the guru? Of course, that's very important. Of course, and you say, okay, Raganuga Bhakti by definition means following the footsteps of the Ragatmikas. And that's how Rupa Goswami describes Raganuga Bhakti. Before describing Raganuga Bhakti, he describes Ragatmika Bhakti. Now, Ragatmika refers to those whose Atma is made of Raga, Raga Atmika, who are made of Raga. Raga means passion, passionate love for Krishna. So here we are not talking about normal jivas, normal souls, Tathasta Shakti. We are talking about Ragatmikas, people made of love for Krishna. So that's another category of entities, and we will call them Ragatmikas or eternal associates of Krishna. Nitya Parishads, you put the name you want, but it refers to them. So they are made of love for Krishna. And they are the role models to follow. So, in one sense, to follow the guru means to follow those people. And those who follow those people, and those who follow those people, and eventually, ideally, that chain connects with current gurus that are connected to you in your life, that are connected to their gurus and their gurus, and so on and so forth, till it goes back to those eternal associates as they appear, for example, in Gaur Lila, accompanying Mahaprabhu. And that's how all the lineages in the Gaudiya Sampradaya are formed, basically, technically speaking. All different currents or branches of the tree of Mahaprabhu, who is the original root or trunk of the tree, as it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. All these branches, Nityananda Prabhu, Advaita Prabhu, Gadadhar Pandit, Shyamananda, Narottam, and lineage between branches within those branches and branches within, like a tree. But all of them come in connection to Mahaprabhu and his eternal associates, Ragatmikas. No? Who, of course, there's the Krishna Lila, the Ragatmikas in Krishna Lila, but those same companions appear in Gaur Lila. And from that, the different Vaishnava lineages are formed, and we are here ideally connected with the lineage that goes back to this personality. So my point is, That's what it means to, Raghunuga Bhakti means to follow the guru, but the guru is not an isolated figure, right? The guru is someone who is following their guru and their, so there's an ongoing set of following to the footsteps, right? Anuga, Raga Anuga, that's this word Anugatya comes from in Sanskrit. Anugatya means like some form of submission or following the footsteps of someone. And the in itself, the expression following the footsteps is important. Today I met with the disciple of Srila Sridhar Maharaj. We're having a nice conversation about this principle of, okay, Rupa Goswami, follow the footsteps of Rupa, of the associate of Krishna in Vrindavan. And many times in our tradition, we also receive this point. But you can start paying close attention to how they appear in Gaur Lila. Because in Gaur Lila, they appear as sadhakas. They appear as devotees practicing bhakti. So that may be quite relatable to where you are. But at the same time, still, sometimes it may not be quite relatable in the sense that, okay, I'll see how Tulsi Manjari in Vrindavan, who is appears in the Gaur Lila as Raghunath Das Goswami. So I will follow in his footsteps and that will be more relatable. And then you see that Raghunath Das Goswami hardly sleeps, hardly eats. And it's like, oh, I don't know if I can relate to that, right? So how much I can follow those footsteps? So the idea of following the footsteps is an expression in English, but in Sanskrit, there are two expressions. One in connection to this is anusar. Anusar, which means anu, means following, like raga anuga. Anugatya, anu, so anu means like to go after. Anus and sar means in Sanskrit essence, no? Like saragrahi. So anusar means to follow the essence of what they are conveying, which means to follow the essence means to be essentialist enough, not only to see the essence, but to see how that essence applies to your situation in a realistic way. How can I get inspired with Raghunath Das Goswami almost not eating and not sleeping in a way that I do not become dysfunctional trying to emulate him by not eating and not sleeping when I don't have that capacity? But how do I relate to that without discarding the whole thing? Because no, that's not relatable to me. Don't bring Raghunath Das Goswami to the conversation. Yeah, bring it. But how to follow the essence of the principle? And today we were having an interesting conversation in that regard because one point that he made was okay, at the same time, the Goswamis were showing, establishing some example, like utter deep, high example. But it doesn't mean that, in many ways, that example that sometimes may sound like a little bit too much was a way to teach by example in a very, I don't want to sound, use the sound, the word is extreme, but very intense way. But it doesn't mean that we were talking that has to necessarily be the way to do it. We were even talking about maybe on earth giving the example to others they were like that, but in the Nitya Navadvip, in eternal Navadvip, when there's nobody you need to preach to, you may not need to be that intense. Because you don't need to give an example to anyone. No, they're all enlightened beings. But again, following the footsteps, anusar. Anukar means imitation. So we don't want to imitate in a way that is copy-pasting without acknowledge where I am. So following the footsteps of the Brajavasis, of the Goswamis, or of the Guru even, again, means also a deep acknowledgement of where I am now. And of course, a deep willingness to move forward, to grow, but based on where I am now. No, I cannot try to follow the essence or the footsteps of my guru, of my gurus, in a way that is an escape from where I am now. Because many times we end up doing that. In the name of following the footsteps, we are just running away from where we are and who we are. So it becomes the perfect evasive mechanism, perfect form of escapism. Now I'm just following the footsteps of Rupa Manjari in Golok Vrindavan, and you have so many unresolved issues in your life that are constantly getting in the way in your relationships or your life, of your practice. But you don't want to see those because you are too busy emulating Rupa Manjari, so to say. And many times that's sheer escapism, spiritual bypassing. I'm not saying always, but I've seen that a lot. It can happen very easily. So yeah, in principle, replying to your first question, following the footsteps of Sri Gurus has to do with Raganuga Bhakti, because what Rupa Goswami does in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is he first describes Vaidhi Bhakti in detail and gives 64 angas of Vaidhi Bhakti. The first one is Ado Guru Padashraya, take shelter in Guru. Then Sri Krishna Dikshadi Sikshanam, taking shelter in a Guru implies getting to know the person, hearing from that person, relating, opening yourself to that. It's a gradual process. And there's siksha there. Then he says, Sri Krishna Dikshadi Sikshanam. So then comes eventually Diksha to formalize the connection. Then comes then continues to be siksha. No. But it starts with Guru. And then Rupa Goswami, after describing all that in the context of Vaidhi Bhakti, he then says, now Raganuga Bhakti. And he says, basically all the angas or the expressions of Vaidhi Bhakti also apply to Raganuga Bhakti. The main difference is in inner motivation. Most of those angas, there are a few exceptions that Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur mentions in Raghavarman Chandrika, but most of them are just basically applicable to Raganuga Bhakti. So it begins, in that sense, you could say Raganuga Bhakti will begin following that list of Rupa Goswami with taking shelter of a guru. So in that sense, yes. How much does Raganuga Bhakti means following the footsteps of a guru? Well, a lot, a deal, a big deal of that. Because again, Raganuga Bhakti is all about becoming, how to say, receiving the bhakti samskars, the devotional impressions that will make us more and more fit to serve in that particular realm. And those things are received, devotional impressions. So we receive that from those who have it. And that's why Chaitanya Charitamrita says, Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. The seed of the creeper of devotion is given, or one receives that from the by the grace of Guru and Krishna. So there's a giving and a receiving of that. So yeah, it's crucial to have that connection, with different people that are in that mood, basically. Whatever mood one is looking after, or many times one is not looking after any mood to begin with. And eventually one ends up having certain mood by having been associated with people who already have certain attraction. And regarding the second question, how far can we go in terms of imagination in the context of Raganuga Bhakti? Well, there are different ways to talk about it, but in the beginning, of course, our acharyas will try to prevent imagination in one sense, in the sense of, again, if you are not properly grounded about what's Raganuga Bhakti, who is Krishna, what's the nature of the Leela, how to say, how to make proper sense of different emotions that happen in Vrindavan, how not to indulge in rasa abhas and proper mixture of moods, you may better not go too much into your imagination, because you may make a mess of Rajalila and combine things in ways that are not proper and that are incoherent. And again, not to make anyone feel limited or, oh, I don't have full freedom, but probably not. Probably we don't have full freedom because we don't have full freedom. We are not fully free. So I'm still trapped by different limitations. So how can I demand to have full freedom when I myself do not have full freedom by my own ch the very own choices I've made in the past? So first I may need to be purified and educated and freed from many things before I can actually dare to employ my imagination in a disciplined way, in a coherent way, in an educated way. When one gets a proper, how to say, balance someone's mind, because again, if you're if our mind is still too unstable, too crazy sometimes, it can go anywhere and everywhere. How much can you trust? Okay, I will now enter into the realm of imagination and trust my mind that will take me to the ideal. Probably that will shouldn't be the beginning. Again, not to create a neurosis about distrusting yourself, but being realistic about how much am I in control of this? Just sit for a few minutes and see how much the mind goes shopping and how many shops it visits in a few seconds. Hopefully not that many, and one can have presence and focus. But if that's not the case, that's why repeatedly our acharyas have emphasized or have cautioned us about the premature, like running after certain things when there is no preliminary qualification to properly honor and understand those higher realities. Mahaprabhu himself did that. He gradually became more and more internally absorbed till he ended up his last 12 years of his life inside the Gambhira, relishing esoteric topics with a few selected associates. But that was the Antalila, the end part of his life. The rest of his life, he was giving other examples. Now that you first need to address some other issues, and all in the context that in the service of that final absorption, but it's a gradual unfolding. So in the beginning, I will say more than how to say, letting our imagination go loose and go wherever it wants in the context of Raganuga Bhakti. First, we need to be grounded. First, we need to understand what's Raganuga Bhakti, right? And what it means to follow the Vrajavasis. Who are the Vrajavasis? What's the difference? What's the uniqueness of the Vrajavasis? Not to say, not to create any toxic hierarchy, but okay, if this the path I'm choosing, what's the path about? What's that? What's the goal of the path? I mean, again, it takes time to get educated about that. And this is not just intellectual, because for us, study of scripture or listening to this revelation is not gyan, like just dry, rational, intellectual information. It's bhakti, right? To receive sambandha gyan, to receive proper knowledge about who we are, who Krishna is, what's the relationship between everything. That's bhakti. That's an expression of devotion. So it shouldn't be taken as, oh, that's just mere stuff in your head, and we are not intellectual. We just want to feel the whole thing. We may end up being sentimentalists also. So balance head and heart. According to our Adhikar, each one have their own head and heart. We are unique, so we have to be discerning enough to properly engage everything. And imagination has its place. When you have relatively your impulses under control, you have proper imagination, proper knowledge, grounding in Raganuga Bhakti. In theory, you have a relatively steady, deep practice. There is a place for imagination to not to speculate and create something that makes no sense, but to allow itself to put together certain things that actually come as an inspiration from a purified mind. So it's not imagination in the sense of just random anarchic speculation, but it's a spontaneous inspiration that arises. But when one has reached certain level, I would say, of clarity, maturity, knowledge, realization. Because if not, it'd be just something childish, and it's something more like still very self-centered. Like, I will see it and imagine this and experience that and feel that. And it's still very much about me feeling stuff or me having this or that. It's not so much about me being committed to offer myself in sacred service to that, which is what Raganuga Bhakti is about. Raganuga Bhakti is not about feeling things selfishly for myself and ecstasy and this. Again, we find so many statements in scripture that great devotees' ecstasy is coming to invade them fully, and they reject the ecstasy. They curse the ecstasy because it's getting in the way of their service. So we have to get those lessons first, so to say, because if not, the Raganuga project may be just another subtle form of sense gratification in a self-centered way. So first we have to cultivate a deep, in the words of Srila Siddharth, a deep foundation of surrender, Sharanagati. He will say, devotion without surrender is imitation. No. So surrender, surrender, Saranagati. And again, what's Saranagati? So many aspects of that. And again, we need to, I don't want to sound nerdy and giving you homework to memorize verses and learn by heart which are the different aspects of Saranagati and which is the official definition of Uttam Bhakti. And it's not about getting the definition by heart and reciting it to the teacher at the class and being a good girl and a good boy, but it's about having all these revelations at hand for us internally. So, and I can make them a constant reminder in my heart on a daily basis. Okay, what's Saranagati? What Jiva Goswami said? What's the Angi of the six Angas? What's the main aspect? Koptritvevarana, you are being maintained by Krishna. Okay, how to enter that spirit? How to live my life from that? Again, if I have no clue about that, and it's just a concept in a book, again, it's not just a concept. It's something that you can, again, learn by heart. That's a beautiful expression in English. We don't say learn by head. It's learn by heart. But generally, we think committing it to memory. Learn by heart is way better. Maybe it starts with the heart, the head. You hear the concept. But then it has to go down and converge into the ocean of the heart. So anyhow, I'm going here and there, but a few words also on the role of imagination. But again, many times rather than resorting to imagination in a premature way, because many times again, imagination may be a way of escaping reality in the sense that so many things may be already knocking on our door now, and instead of opening that door and learning from that, we may be escaping into imagination, like daydreaming, so we don't have to confront the here and now, in which we can find Krishna. Like also we're talking today with this disciple of Srila Siddharth, Bhaktinandan Swami. I didn't mention his name. We were talking how Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita speaks about how we have to understand the nuances of Dharma, what's Dharma, what's not Dharma. Everything can be Dharma or Adharma, depending what's going on internally. Externally, it may take so many ways. Arjuna battling in the Kurukshetra is, in one sense, a highest form of ahimsa, but it doesn't look like ahimsa. And someone may be passively witnessing a form of abuse without doing anything, and that's violence. Though externally it sounds very passive. So we're exploring all the things, and we were saying how at the end of the day, the conclusion of the Gita is Sarvadharmam Parityaja, abandon everything and just surrender to me. And Srila Siddharth interprets that verse, the conclusion of the Gita, as in relation to the gopis, that the gopis receive so many obstacles, so many challenges. And like Arjuna was in a situation of challenge, the gopis are in so many challenges that put to test their devotion. I mean, Krishna plays the flute, and it doesn't mean that they have an Uber waiting on the door and they can sleep in through the night and meet Krishna without any problem. There's so much risk taking. So my point with all this is, they receive the challenge, they receive the obstacle, and they get nourished by the obstacle. They include the obstacle in such a way that it nourishes their love. So that's the gopis. That's the highest example to be following Raganuga Bhakti. So a way of practicing Raganuga Bhakti also is not only to run into my world of imagination and visualizing the gopis sorting out obstacles to reach for Krishna after this flute call, but also how do I deal with the obstacles that I perceive in my daily life and get nourished by those obstacles in my avisar, in my love journey towards the divine. So that's another way of being realistically applying the essential principles of Raganuga Bhakti on a day to day. And again, I don't need to resort to imagination there. I just need to confront things in a very concrete way. And maybe use my imagination in thinking, in being creative about how to integrate this. What's the lesson here? If you want to call that the form of imagination or thinking creatively, how this thing that I see as a very big obstacle, undesirable stuff, can nourish my love journey, my abhisar. Because that's the gopis do not even need to think about that. That flows in them spontaneously. You throw them 108 obstacles, and somehow or other they can transform all that into nourishment in their love journey. We may not have that spontaneous capacity, that imagination, that creativity, so we may need to first train ourselves in that, in a disciplined way, spend some time thinking, discerning, praying, making an effort, taking guidance, how to transform this particular challenge or obstacle into food, nourishment, udipan, like stimulant. So anyhow, some thoughts. I don't know if that addresses some of your points, Jayadev Prabhu.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Swami Padmanabha. I'm really touched, and I took a lot of notes, and I will spend some time with the points you made. And yeah, I heard before that yeah, if we go in our imagination, we have to have boundaries, and maybe we should stop when it comes to touching of spiritual bodies, for example, you know, maybe we are not mature to get there. So very much, thank you very much to make some aspects clear here. Yeah.
Thank you. And of course, again, it's not about stigmatizing imagination and making people feel afraid or bad or guilty. But as you say, healthy boundary, so we don't also run to imagination as escapism, right? And again, we can translate imagination, our current state for most of us, as thinking creatively, not like imagining a new perspective of things. That's a way of talking about imagination. Okay, I used to deal with things in this way. Let's imagine a new way of dealing with it. Now, change your angle of vision, in Srila Siddhartha's words, and how to deal with the challenges, nourishment. It's a form of working on with my imagination in a realistic way for my stage. And at every stage, there will be a healthy way of relating to imagination. It's not that it's canceled till this stage. No, at every stage you can use your imagination, but in a healthy, realistic, corresponding way, not escapism and not as repression or canceling, absolute canceling. So yeah, thank you. Okay, let's send you one more time to the breakthrough rooms for a few minutes, and so you can continue exploring imaginatively and creatively with healthy boundaries. What we just talked, it was two things into one, but all revolving around Raganuga Bhakti, following the footsteps of guru and imagination, creativity. So see you in a few minutes back, and we next have Kanupriya's question. Welcome you all back. Hoping you had again exciting, dynamic, why not challenging sharing with all of you. Not challenging, it's fine. Whatever needs to be brought to the masala of today. So if my memory is not failing me, the next raised hand came from Kanupriya. I saw Vishaka raising her hand, but let's honor the proper order. And before that was Kanupriya from Scotland. We have two Kanupriyas, so we have to qualify the statement. So we invite Kanupriya to unmute herself, and then we'll address Vishaka's question from Sweden.
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, my question is somehow a little bit related to the first two ones. So I just found that very interesting how that always comes together. It's almost like guided, isn't it? So I was actually asking myself when I was in Vrindavan, I think it was 2 years ago, I was in a very beautiful satsang. And the topic was about prayers of our acharyas, and how important it is that we really pray and recite these prayers of our acharyas. And then I asked the questions, and how about our own prayers? Because I feel it is very important that we try also to express our prayers in our own language, in what comes from our heart. And the answer was very clear that we should not do that. We should really follow the prayers of the acharyas, because everything is in it, all the bhav is in it, and because these prayers are so perfect and so, it's almost like they guide us. If we recite these prayers, they guide us into the relationship. And I got this answer, and now during Kartik, I decided to write every day a prayer to Srimati Radharani, just at the end of the day, feelings that came out of my heart. And I really felt how this month was important to really, it was really enrich the relationship. I felt it is such a gift to find my own words and my own I don't know the word in English. Yeah, just to praise the divine in my own words. And but then I still had this answer in my head all the time: you should not do that, you should follow the prayers of the acharyas. So I wanted to ask you about your opinion, Maharaj. What do you say to that topic?
It seems that you already took your own decision about it, so
I always do what I finally want to do, but that's not always the best. So I here really would love to have a second opinion.
I'm saying that in the sense that I agree with the way you did it, the call that took you to compose your own prayers. I'm talking in general. I don't know the context in which you asked that question in that particular satsang, who replied, and we don't need to go into those details. But my point is, of course, as we say before, regarding the topic of imagination, there can be some degree of caution to some people at some stage in terms of not necessarily that you cannot write your prayers and don't do anything by yourself, but also on the side more of, pay attention how these great personalities pray it.
Mm-hmm.
No? It's not that what you pray for is wrong, but maybe by listening to their prayers or understanding them, that can broaden and expand your own idea of what to pray about, so to say, or to pray for, how to do it. And then, of course, you can still make it your own. You have to own those prayers. It's not enough that they've written them and I just copy paste them or repeat them. I'm not saying it's bad. I've learned hopefully by heart many of those prayer sections in the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam itself is filled with prayers, different sections of just one prayer after another, and they are beautiful.
Mm.
It's not like, okay, but that's not my own prayer, so I don't care for that. We shouldn't be that indifferent, right? So if it's always beautiful if you know, okay, here you have a saintly enlightened person praying to God, probably you will be curious, okay, how they are praying. No, how, what they are, it doesn't mean that I have to imitate. Again, it doesn't mean that I have to force myself to be there, but I should be ideally curious about, open to receive, learn to pray to begin with. Because, but at the same time, of course, Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita says, "Artha jignyasura artarthi." Different people approach me. Those who are afflicted by suffering and want relief, those who want money, basically, financial development, those who want knowledge, and some of those who want me. Not that many, he says with a side of sadness. But most people do not approach me for me. They want what I can provide to them. But the point with that is, the implication is there are prayers attached to all that. right? The people who approach Krishna for money, they pray to approaching Krishna for money means praying to Krishna for money. Approaching Krishna for relief of suffering implies putting that into prayer. And he's not saying that's all bad. He's saying probably that's where you are, and you can connect with that prayer more deeply because that's where you are. So let's begin there. So Krishna's not saying discard all that and just recite the pure prayers of Narottam Das Thakur always. Don't come with me with all the other stuff. I mean, he's saying there are different people, different approaches. Of course, we are in a school of bhakti. More specifically, we'll call it Uttam Bhakti, Shuddha Bhakti. So even in principle, in conception, we try to understand. And I was talking that day with a devotee who was in a complex financial situation. And he told me, Maharaj, I know I should not pray to Krishna for financial development. I know that's not, I don't want my relationship to Krishna to be about money. No? So he was in that, but he was in a really difficult place. So I appreciated both things. Like he said, I prayed to Krishna for that. But I at the same time, I not felt guilty about it, but just felt I don't want that relationship with him. It sounds transactional. I don't want him to just be my money provider. So I appreciated also his expressing that. That's part of the dance of being a sadhaka, right? Like that shows that you are getting right, that at least in principle, we don't want to approach God to make him our servant, basically, right? We want to become servants and we want to develop gradually some concern and identification with the service necessity, tending to the necessities of love, as I like to put it. So, but again, in that context, we cannot superficially just to imitate, as we say before, imitating, following the footsteps. We can imitate, we can read the prayers of our Goswamis and the Bhagavatam, so many prayers. There's an abundance. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Narottam Das Thakur, entire books of prayers, Prarthana, Saranagati, this and that. And of course, that's beautiful and that's inspiring. And the scripture, Vandanam, that's one of the main expressions of bhakti. Vandanam could mean to offer prayers, but to offer prayers also means you can recite prayer from someone else, but hopefully connecting them to your situation, right? Somehow make them relatable. It's not just the prayer of Britrasur in the Bhagavatam, and I'm just like parroting it, and it has nothing to do with my life. No, try to make own that prayer, how that speaks to me, and that takes some work. You need to enter into that. But also there is a place for offering your prayers and writing your prayers and composing your prayers. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam that says that you can praise Bhagavan. There's this, in Sanskrit, you have this expression, stava and stuti. One means reciting ancient prayers composed by someone else. The other means reciting or composing your own prayers in contemporary languages, so to say. And the Bhagavatam also say you can praise Bhagavan not only in Sanskrit meter, so to say, but also in your native tongue. And as you say, in your own wording, in your own, the way that it feels familiar and natural for you to address the Absolute. It's a way of owning all that, owning the relationship, making it more personal. Again, without... And at the same time, you are being guided in a particular tradition, so you are receiving some input and education about, okay, who is Krishna, and what's the approach we want to offer to him. So it's not that by composing our own prayer, we are widely going into an imagination where we end up doing the extreme nonsense. That's not the idea, of course. So that's sometimes why some people may say, no. Don't do your prayers, don't write prayers, just limit yourself to, sorry, repeating these prayers. But also, it's dangerous because even if, I understand the point, start by learning these prayers, but still you have to make them relatable to you. Because if not, there's a big, huge gap there. Right? It's like there's Bhaktivinoda Thakur saying this, and I'm not repeating that, but I don't feel anything with that. And it's different topic, but related. That's why I personally also agree that many of these verses or songs that we sing many times in Sanskrit or Bengali could also be translated into our native local languages, because many practitioners do not know Sanskrit or Bengali. So you can memorize the verse, but you don't know what you are saying actually. It sounds nice, it sounds cool, it's Sanskrit. Everyone is seeing me repeating and they know that I know it, but that's not the point of doing it. That it has to awaken some feeling. So if you don't know what you are singing about, probably you may not be able to fully convey all that could be offered if you knew what you are talking about. So sometimes, A, you learn what the Sanskrit or the Bengali means. So when you sing it in that language, you actually can add the feeling and not just be reading the paper, just not to miss the original letters and tongues, and you are trying to follow what to say in the next line because you don't know how to pronounce it. And it becomes more a heady thing, trying not to fail and read properly, or translate those songs into your native language. Or again, of course, you can compose your own songs. Again, there has to be some foundation of proper Siddhanta and understanding and practice to compose a song that is aligned with the tradition. Again, and I don't want to make all this sound too rigid, but if we make it too loose also, I can write songs for Krishna that may not be the ideal, so to say. And of course, again, we none of us begin from the ideal, so let's be realistic. But that's not an excuse to not try to learn how to make myself a more and more like accurate, refined offering for Bhagavan. If I want to love Krishna purely, okay, what does it mean? It means a lot of things, and I need to, and it does not mean a lot of things. So I need to get it clear gradually what it actually means to love Krishna purely, to give myself in a proper way in service to Guru Vaishnava, to everyone, and what it does not mean. And gradually, you know? So, but yeah, there is a place I remember last year in our UK retreat, we gave one lecture on contemplative prayer. And I remember that one of the exercises or homework for the day, one of the two we made was I invited all the participants to write your own prayer to Krishna. And I know that for many it was like shocking, like me writing my own prayer to Krishna, but I kind of I never did. Okay, do it. Right. It may not be the most accurate Siddhantic thing, and we may not publish it in a book like the ultimate conclusion of the Sampradaya yet. Who knows? But it's good to exercise that muscle and inner muscle of having developing your own voice, developing your own personality, and learning to enter into that dialogue and conversation with the divine. And if there is proper guidance, if there are some inaccuracies, so to say, or things that could be further refined, one will be open to that feedback, and that will happen in time, right? It is, but we cannot cancel that altogether till you become a pure devotee, so to say, right? It's not natural, and I will say that you felt that was not natural for you, and you had this need, and you made it practical into your Kartik bow, writing this letter, and to me it seems that it worked for you. So as it worked for you, it can work for many others as well. So I don't know if that helps.
It helps a lot. Thank you very much. It helps a lot because I truly believe we do have an individual relationship at the very end or with the divine. So then also our path should be individual. And if I cannot express my individuality, then I find it hard to start really to feel. I can feel if I'm part of this path and not just taking everything that is given to me. So And to start feeling means to start to express myself. And maybe it's imperfect at the beginning, but if Radha Krishna are unconditional love themselves, so that means they accept my imperfection. I truly believe that. It helped a lot. Thank you so much, Maharaj.
Thank you. And again, it's always a very fine line because again, you cannot tell people, okay, you are not perfect yet, so you cannot write your prayers, you cannot speak for yourself, you cannot think, you cannot, you just have to copy paste the perfect people. It's too much. But also you cannot say, just do whatever you want and think and feel whatever you want, and that's okay. It's too much also. So how to keep the balance, right? It's an ongoing recalibration and adjustment to, okay, have, as you say, I'm an individual. It's an individual relationship. It's very unique, very personal. And I have to offer myself as perfect as I can, whatever I am, as imperfect as I may be still. And that's the best I can do today. Tomorrow is another story and another story. And as you say, trusting into the unconditional love of Radha and Krishna, omitting certain technical details that may not be fully accurate, but also us being open to be further guided and refined by them, by our guides, and by life itself. So if there's that sincerity, that openness, that's the most important thing, I will say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's go again to breakthrough rooms. Why not? And then we will finish with Vishaka's question. Let's turn together for a few more moments some thoughts and feelings about this notion of having our own voice, giving ourselves permission to be ourselves as imperfectly as it may happen to be for the pleasure of the divine, and whatever you feel inspired to share, testimonies, experiences, challenges, gifts of realization. So Teresa, you can invite us there and see you in a few moments. Okay. Welcome back one more time. Hey, still too short. What to do? That's how it works. Union and separation. That's how life operates. So even in Zoom dynamics, union now, separation. So we'll conclude with Vishaka's question. I imagine it's Vishaka, though I see you accompanied today, so I don't know.
Yes.
Over there.
And actually, this is my friend Panchavati. Pleasure. We have known each other for many years, many decades, 40. Actually. 40 years, more or less. So it's actually my friend Panchavati who has a question today.
Hey, welcome, Panchavati, and please present whatever you like.
Yeah, very nice that you have this particular program. So I want to ask, like the concept of a transcendence, how, when, and where, and also woven into the subject matter you've spoken about before here tonight, the transcendence. And many years ago, I was like asked, I was not doing good when I was asked to collect money in ISKCON. So I failed all the time and I was banned by told, you have to be transcendental. You have to become transcendental so you can collect more. Does it mean I am transcendental when I'm there, but then I get home, then I'm not transcendental. So I would like to understand the concept of transcendence. When is that state right? You know, where is that state? And does people come to it and then they come down from it, up and down and here and there? Or is it a temporary thing that you reach and then, and can it be in this material world? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I see you are accompanied there by a third companion.
Yes, yes.
Cat. So appeared on the camera. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. And yeah, it's important to try to get a clear idea of words, right? You're asking about the word transcendence or being transcendental, and these are words that many times are there in the lingo, in the glossary, in the language of, in this case, our Gaudiya Vaishnava community. But what do they mean, right? Like we were saying, okay, surrender or humility or love, or but what do we mean by that? Many times there is something else we mean, like the example you gave, which I never heard that, which is interesting. Well, like you have to become transcendental, which means collect more money.
Right.
That's very interesting, right? So if you are not a good collector, that you are not so transcendental. So right. The fact that the more money in your pocket, the closer you are to God. Now you end up creating any and every philosophy. You can accommodate anything, right? So, so that's interesting, right? But for me, with all respect to the person who said that, but that's, I wouldn't say it was with bad intention, probably, but it's a form of weaponizing the term, right? Transcendence means whatever I need to be now. So if I need you to collect more money, then being transcendental means to collect more money. If I need you to whatever, I need something. Okay, this is what now transcendental means. Now the definition has been updated today, and being transcendental today means the people who whatever wash more pots is more transcendental, because we need to wash pots today. So we redefine transcendence according to the need of the moment. And I don't think that's healthy. So I personally like every time the word transcendence comes, of course, for me, transcendence doesn't mean collect more money necessarily. It can take the form of collecting money and for the service of Bhagavan in a transcendental way, but it doesn't mean that it's only that and that may not be transcendental as well. For me, transcendental is, of course, there are different ways of speaking about it. Let's always be specific about the things. There are degrees of speaking about transcendence, ways of talking about it. It's not just this one thing. But in general, I like to think of transcendental or transcendence as integration, which may sound like, what does it have to be to do one thing with the other? Because sometimes transcendental means, many times the implication is to be beyond something, right? To not be affected by what generally affects people, like transcend this thing. No? Like, okay, I'm angry. Transcend your anger. Let's give an example. That's another way which many times I've heard that expression. Oh, I'm angry. Oh, you have to be transcendental. The fact that you are angry means that, sorry, you are not there yet. So it creates exclusion, it creates guilt, probably it makes you repress your anger, and it doesn't make you belong. It makes you feel outside of the transcendental club, right? But, and it gives a wrong idea of transcendental, because when we study transcendence in our tradition, which will be, it's Golok Vrindavan, let's say, and Krishna and his, and everyone in Vrindavan, and there's anger there. So there's anger in transcendence, while someone here on earth told me that I have to transcend my anger. You follow my point? Oh, I'm angry. Oh, you should not be angry. You should be transcendental, no more anger. But then when you look at the highest form of transcendence for us, there's anger. Another form of anger, okay, transcendental anger, but still is anger. So they're not repressing their anger. They're just expressing it in a certain way. So that's why I say, for me, transcendence is integration. Integration for me is not rejecting anything, but how to express that in a healthy way. So, because many times we think transcendence in terms of rejection. I have to transcend this. I have to transcend that. I have to transcend this. No. Instead of, I have to learn how to integrate this. Okay, I'm angry. Transcending anger wouldn't mean for me repress anger, deny anger, feel ashamed because you're angry, deny it. No, acknowledge it first. I'm angry. Own it, take responsibility for it without guilt and shame toxically, and then try to understand why I'm angry. What's the message behind the anger? Many times behind anger, there is sadness. Behind anger, there is unfulfilled necessities or unfulfilled something. So anger is just many times a symptom of something else. So what's that? What's there? What's there? What's there? Till you reach something more essential. And then how this is teaching me, how I can learn from this. And then when you got the jewel, the gift, you can integrate that into your journey. So then you have integrated anger. And many times part of that is expressing your anger. It's not that anger cannot be expressed. Many times should be expressed to set proper boundaries. I'm just giving the example of anger, right? So that's a way of integrating it. And that's transcending anger. Again, you're not rejecting it. You are integrating it. You're making it part of your journey in a healthy way, in a nourishing way. That's real transcendentalism. It's not about rejecting everything. Because if you reject everything, you end up with nothing. So our tradition is not about rejecting, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur say, our path is not neti, 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 like in the Advaitins will say, neti, neti means this is not, this is not, this is not, this is illusion, this is illusion, this is not, no, 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 no. If you end up too much into that pattern, you end up, he will say, in the impersonal Brahman. Because it's all about what's not, denying, 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 instead of how to accept everything in a positive way in relationship to Krishna. So that's real transcendentalism for us. Now, that's the definition that Rupa Goswami gives of yukta vairagya, of proper renunciation. Anashaktasya visayam yathartham upayunjataha nirbandha Krishna sambandhi yuktam vairagya mujjate. So proper renunciation is to see everything in connection to Krishna, to God. He doesn't say proper renunciation is to renounce to anything, interestingly. No, you hear, okay, he will give the definition of renunciation. Let's see which is the list he provides about which are the stuff that we need to renounce. He never mentions about renouncing anything in his definition of renunciation. He just says, nirbandha Krishna sambandha. Try to see everything in sambandha with Krishna, in connection with God. So indirectly, he's saying, renounce that which does not allow you to see things in that way. So of course, money can be also, we can engage with money in a transcendental way, but not to the point of you're not transcendental enough because you haven't collected this amount per day. No, that has nothing to do. That's becoming manipulation, weaponization and manipulation in the name of transcendentalism. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, transcendence doesn't necessarily mean something otherworldly, beyond, far away, that has nothing to do with here and now, but it's mostly how we deal many ways with the here and now in a meaningful way, in a divine way, in a conscious way. How I can put the dots together with Krishna in the center in what looks ordinary to my eyes now. But I will say we should never weaponize transcendence. We should never make other people feel guilty or ashamed in the name of transcendence, right? This is not transcendental. You are not transcendental enough. If you will be transcendental, you will be that in itself, to say that is not transcendental, right? to resort to those type of expressions shows that you are not transcendental. If you say, tell those things to people, if you use transcendence in that way, that speaks about your level of transcendence, with all respect, not the other one. Because yeah, real transcendence is a gentle, compassionate, empathic invitation to engage with reality gradually in ways that are more and more and more God-centered. It's a gradual process. So it entails patience, understanding, compassion toward others, toward ourselves. That's how we grow in transcendence. It's not like I'm pum, jump and I'm suddenly super otherworldly, super transcendent. It's not that. It's not like I became a superhero in a weekend. It's actually integrating all the messiness many times, are the ordinariness of my daily life in a more sacred way, in a more profound way. That's how we gain transcendence. And we don't need to reject anything at one point, because everything at the end of the day starts to talk to me about Krishna, starts to nourish my journey. That speaks about perfect transcendence. That's why in our tradition, the definition of the highest transcendentalist is he or she who sees Krishna in everything and everything in Krishna. So they are in the right in the midst of the world in whatever situation we may be in, but seeing everything properly connected, integrated, harmonized, accommodated. So they don't feel the need to run away from anything, to escape from anything, to go anywhere else, to reject anything, nor to tell people to collect more money. Right? Because again, there are different ways of being transcendental, right? There are different ways of being inspired in that direction. A few examples, of course, and these are examples of Puru and disciple, but you know, Bhakti's Gorkishordas Babaji, the other day we were celebrating his disappearance day. He was very transcendental in his own unique way. And he will live in he will live anywhere. You know, like under a boat, he will chant in a bathroom, in a public toilet. He could be seen anywhere and everywhere, and that was his unique expression, inspired way of expressing his transcendentalism. And his disciple Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was also a renunciant, but one who was very much involved in the world and constructed temples and organized a mission and was very much showing his own way of being transcendental. In one way, he was equally transcendental. Sometimes we think, no, he was not as transcendental. No, no. It takes different forms, right? So he was riding in cars. At that time, again, in India, it was a scandal. Now people get scandalized. Sannyasis get scandalized if they don't have their own car. But at that time, renunciates were expected to walk barefoot to wherever they were going, even if that entailed months of walking. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was riding a car, which was a very new invention. And he was embracing the latest technology, which of course now for us is not a car, but at that time it was, and riding a car. So people were like, you are Vaishnavas. You are not supposed to ride cars, right? You are transcendental, right? And he replied with his own logic, saying only Vaishnavas should be riding cars. Like implying a Vaishnava, by definition, is someone who knows how to connect everything with Krishna. Anyone else who doesn't know how to connect a car with Krishna shouldn't be riding a car. That was his point, right? So, and he walked his talk. Again, he was not using that as an excuse to have 100 Rolls Royce, as some other people had, you know, gurus. He really engaged that in Seva, because that was clear. He built a marble temple, as we were talking today. At that time, that was also scandalizing, because the idea was, if you're a sadhu, you live in your cottage, in your hut, and here you have a marble temple. Now marble temples are everywhere, but at that time there were no marble temples. And he made the whole marble temple. But then he had disciples of him fighting with each other about getting the more cozy and comfortable room for themselves in the marble temple. And he said, you didn't get it. That was not the point of a marble temple. So I'm willing to now take out and sell all the marble for you to get that lesson and print books or engage the mind in something else. The point of the marble was not for you to get attached to coziness in the ashram, but just to show how all the opulence of the world can and should be dedicated to the master of all opulence, Lakshmipati, Bhagavan. So again, my point with all this is that transcendence can take so many different shapes as long as the heart and the spirit is in the right place, right? I don't know if that helps.
Yes, it helps very much. It helps very much, because I asked this many times and nobody's been able to answer. Like the answer you gave is more like clear, and it seems like we have to like kind of work for our transcendence.
Yeah.
We have
to. Yeah.
like you said, we have to use our creativity to engage and to connect with everything you said, to use it to see Krishna and his service.
What it means for me to embrace transcendence today may look very differently than how it may look to any one of you, again. But each one of us is invited to embrace transcendence. So again, the point is transcendence may look different in the outward part, but that doesn't mean that it can be things like the example you gave. You didn't collect enough money. That's not transcendental. Again, you can make a case for anything being transcendental, and many times we are hiding weaponization, manipulation, some other things which are not transcendental. So also requires some discernment and some, and trusting our own discernment. Krishna has given us, we have God-given faculties to discern given moment these things. So we may receive guidance and inspiration, but also we have to develop deep trust in our God-given faculties to discern about the best possible form of transcendence to embrace at any given moment. So,
anyhow. Can we lose that?
Sorry?
Can we lose that capacity? Let's say we have engaged ourselves very much, and can we lose that capacity?
Which capacity?
To be in that state that we engage in that transcendental way.
I mean, we can, I wouldn't say we will lose entirely the capacity. We may not have been, if we are not using that, of course they have this saying, if use it or lose it, but it doesn't mean that it disappears completely from our toolbox, but it may get quite covered and difficult to find again. So it's keep the muscle, as I say, trained, so it's accessible to us and we are familiar with it, and it becomes hopefully normal at one point. It's normalized. It's not something that I resort to once every two decades, but it's a daily engagement and conversation and dialogue that I'm having with all these type of things inside of me. And in good association, that's also important, good association, right? Because we are ideally surrounded by people who are mirroring back this type of discernment and fact and qualities that remind me, do not lose them, do not forget them, do not stop exercising them. These are healthy, important things to remain in touch with reality proper. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. So before concluding, I'm sorry if I went a little bit, transgress a little bit the time limits. Let's share a few more minutes before we put our sharing to rest today. One more last breakthrough room for a few minutes, turning further about this notion of what it means to be transcendental. And see you in a few minutes too for our final goodbye of today. Okay, welcome back one more time. And I hope you had a sweet, short but sweet time together again. And we are putting to rest our discussion for today. And since we touched on the note of being transcendental, I will invite you to be transcendental. And we talk about challenges also today and being nourished by challenges. And here comes the challenge and invitation to be transcendental, which is, at least for some of you, we won't have satsang for the next 2 weeks because we'll be very busy with our Navadvip Parikram. And at those exact timings, we will really be busy on that. So it's once in a year thing. As you know, I try to not cancel even when I'm traveling and time zones changes and all that. But these next two Saturdays, it will be literally impossible. So I invite you to embrace that period of separation, be transcendental. You can review any of the previous satsangs. There are thousands there. Do you never think like, oh, I already heard that one. No need to go there again. Whatever you want to do. And 2 week, a hibernation period to develop some separation mood and union in separation. And then the reunion will be very relishable. But of course, we'll remain in touch somehow or other to the sharing for those who come to the parikram. Of course, we'll meet there. But I want to share that in advance. So you are already informed. We will share that in our groups as well. So That said, thank you so much to all of you for being here today. May you have a blessed end of this week, beginning of the next one. Keep in touch as usual. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol. Sakal Pataru Vishayavipasindu Vyayavachapati Dhanam Bhavanevi Vashayavipasindu.